In today's episode,
I love them. I love the critics.
Haters gonna hate.
Yes, I think you have to just like embrace them. What I do, I took a screenshot. I have the screenshot of the comments in my laptop. When these things happen, it makes me more motivated to show them that they're not right.
This is Bilal Zaidi, and you're listening to Creator Lab, where I learn how to turn ideas into action. I'll bring you conversations with leading entrepreneurs, nonprofit founders, award-winning designers, educators, artists, and everything else in between. We dig deep into their stories, have honest conversations about how they made their ideas come to life, and the lessons learned along the way. This episode is sponsored by The Square Foot. It's the simplest way to find office space. They have a beautiful website where you can transparently browse places by size, by neighborhood, and by price. They'll then pair you up with a salaried broker, so someone who's not incentivized just to rush you into a lease for their own benefit. They are incredibly transparent, and there are hundreds of companies like Breva, Instacart, and Casper who have already used their services. Please check them out on thesquarefoot.com/creatorlab today. Hey, Farish there. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, so just to clarify, first of all, am I saying your name correctly?
Yes, Farish, exactly.
What does Farishta mean? I think I know what it means, but it seems like it's got some exotic meaning to it.
It means angel in Farsi.
Okay, I was right. Okay, we use that. My family speaks Urdu and it's basically the same. So cool. So thanks for coming on. You've got a really, really incredible story. Today we're going to go into all the amazing things you're doing with Code to Inspire. But before we get into that full story, let's just jump straight into it. What is the problem that you guys are trying to solve in Afghanistan right now specifically?
So in a very simple way, we try to empower the girls online using technology and coding.
Okay, cool. So, I mean, from my research and our discussion before, it sounds like when the Taliban were in power up until 2001, there were 900,000 students in the country, but zero of them were women or girls. And that's changed now. It looks like maybe one in three are now girls. So that is the problem that you guys are trying to address, right?
Sure, yeah. Certainly during the Taliban regime, especially women face a lot of issues. And one of them is that they were deprived of accessing education. And as you said, 900,000 students were in Afghanistan, which 0% of women and girls. And now, actually, we have 9 million students, that out of them, 3.6 million of them are girls. So that's a huge accomplishment for women in Afghanistan.
Yeah. And what about in the workforce as well? So it sounds like there's been a big improvement in the number of people in the workforce, too.
Yeah, it's the same. Again, in Afghanistan, during the Taliban regime, there were only 0% of women in workforce. But now we have 15% of women participating in the workforce.
Great. All right. So we're going to go into all the fun stories about your time in Afghanistan and before that. And, you know, for context, you're now based in New York, right?
Yes, I'm based in New York City.
Cool. So why don't we just go back? You actually grew up in Iran, right? What was that like?
Sure. So my family migrated to Iran during the USSR invasion to Afghanistan during the early 80s. And I was born there, and I finished my high school in Iran. So I was there quite a long time. And talking about a refugee being in a country that during that time, they also had a lot of issues in their own countries coming out of the war with Iraq. So it's kind of like in a way that like you are like an unwanted guest.
Yeah.
So
is that how you felt?
Yeah, because people had already had a lot of issues, and then imagine like some other people come to your country and they're also in need and help. So not a lot of people are happy about that. I grew up in a family with 8 kids, so we were a lot of kids in a family.
Wait, were you the youngest or what?
I was the fifth one.
Fifth one. Oh, yes. So you're right in the middle.
Yes. And yeah, so I my parents, they left everything in Afghanistan when they went to Iran. So they started from zero. And I remember that my mom learned how to stitch. So with that, she could create like clothing and sell them, and she could bring an income to the family. And with that, she could buy school supplies for us.
Yeah, so
definitely being a refugee and being born in a country that it's not your country has a lot of obstacles and challenges.
Yeah.
And the other thing that still a lot of refugees in Iran, they face, the Afghan refugees, is accessing education. So even though I was born in Iran, I wasn't a citizen, so they don't give you a citizenship. You still have a card, which is written you're a refugee, and you carry it with yourself everywhere. And whenever you want to go to school, you have to a certain permission to show the school. And then with that permission, they let you go. So a lot of Afghan kids, they couldn't go to school because they didn't have the permission. So I was lucky enough that my father could get that permission so I could finish my high school.
Yeah. So your mom was basically an entrepreneur, right?
Yes.
And what about your dad? What did he do?
So he was working in mainly social activities. So he was helping Afghan refugees to get their right documents and be settled down in Iran.
Nice. So then what happened? How did you, what made you guys move back to Afghanistan?
So after the fall of Taliban in 2001, my father went back to Afghanistan, to Herat, which is actually the city that my parents come from. And he, due to some work, he stayed there for a couple of months, and then he felt that he didn't like the situation that we are in Iran. He's in Afghanistan, and he talked to us, and he said that maybe that's the time that we go back to our country and start a new life in our own country. And then that's how we decided to go back to Afghanistan.
But by this point, did you feel like you're an Afghan, or did you feel more Iranian? Like, I mean, it's quite a philosophical question, but you know, what did you really feel like? I mean, it's hard to know sometimes.
That's an interesting question, because I never felt I'm Iranian, although I was born there and I made friends and I finished my high school. But still, I had these strong roots in myself from being an Afghan. I always had... I always asked my mom to talk about the stories that she had in Afghanistan as a kid growing up. And she had a lot of amazing stories, looking at my mom's story album and memory book. So I always felt a lot connected to Afghanistan.
I don't know much about Afghanistan. My family is originally from Pakistan, so not too far. This sounds like a real foreigner thing to say, but I've read like The Kite Runner. Have you read that?
Yes, yeah.
And how accurate is The Kite Runner in depicting Afghanistan accurately?
I mean, it depends. but I can say, yes, that was like a picture of Afghanistan, especially the time before the Soviet came and before the war. So it was like a very happy, nice picture. The same thing that my mom always talks about. So I really can connect with that book and also the movie that I watched.
Yeah. So, okay, so you get back to Afghanistan. What was that feeling like? You were 16, right?
Yeah, I was like 16, 17 years old going back to Afghanistan. That was like a very bittersweet experience because, again, you leave a country you were born and you made a lot of friends. So you still feel connected to the friends, and you leave and you want to go to a country that you don't know anything rather than what your parents talk about. And that was like an interesting story, the journey that I took to Afghanistan. We took the car to go from Mashhad, the city that we were living in Iran, to Herat. And because Herat is in the west of Afghanistan, it's really near to that city. So we had a car, we put all the stuff and the equipments and the furnitures, everything, and we drove to Afghanistan border. So everything was fine until there. But then once we arrived, I remember the day was very, it was a very windy day. It was November, and it was dusty. You barely could see green around the area. And there were a lot of like people like us waiting in the line to show their documents and go to just pass the border. And so that was like my first impression of the Afghanistan.
Yeah. Did you get through the border okay, or was there drama?
Yes, yeah, I think everyone was so happy to see that overwhelming amount of people who are coming back to the country. So it was like a very happy environment, because like you see a lot of people that actually, like my family, haven't been back for like 20 years or more, and then their relatives are at the border and they're like crying, hugging them after a long time being separated because of war. So that was like a very emotional moment.
And you were 16, 17, so did it really register with you at that age? Like, I mean, you're still old enough to kind of know what's going on, but do you remember how you felt then? Was it the same for you?
Yeah, I was very emotional too, because like I could see my grandfather, which he was in Afghanistan and never left Afghanistan. So I could see him. I've never seen him when I was in Iran. So I saw some people that I never met in my life, but I just heard about them.
Yeah.
So that was, yeah, really emotional, and it was very good. Okay. I felt very connected.
Yeah. So you moved back, but this is 2001, 2002, right?
Yes, 2002.
So at this point, there's still a war going on, right?
So yes, I mean, not in Herat, in some part of Herat province, but mainly in the south of Afghanistan, which is Kandahar. They were still being affected.
So where you guys were, you weren't as impacted by what was going on?
No, not that much.
All right. So then you move back, you're 16, 17, and you're getting back into school, right? And at this stage, we had lunch a few weeks ago, and we talked about this funny story. And I said to you, how did you get into computer science? Because now you're building these schools for girls to learn coding in Afghanistan, right? And it was quite funny, you didn't like computer science, right? So how did you end up in computer science?
Yes, I really didn't like computer science, because my major actually in Iran during the high school was literature. So I was in love with literature, and I had a huge love for poetry, philosophy, and I wanted to be a lawyer or maybe mainly like in a literature field I wanted to be. But then I remember that we went to Afghanistan. So it was the time that you had to register for the general exam to go to university. So my sister and I, we registered and we went, we did the exam. And in the exam time, it was interesting that I barely could answer the chemistry, physics and math questions, because I didn't have the background. And then one day that they announced the results, my sister came to me and I was like, you can't believe which field of study you are going to do university.
She said that to you?
Yeah. And I was like, don't tell me that it was computer science, because I remember that I said, I won't pick this field of study.
Well, it was like the last thing you'd want to pick. Yeah.
And then she was like, no, exactly, that's computer science. Yeah. And I was so upset.
Yeah.
So upset.
And you went, you said you went home and were crying or something, right?
Yes. I went home, I cried a lot. I told my father that I'm not going to go to this field of study, but he said that give it a try, go there for 1 week, and if you like it, then that's fine. If you don't, just change your field of study.
Yeah, that's how parents always get you in. My dad did the same. He ordered the prospectus for me and circled the course that I eventually did. He kind of planted this seed and he was like, oh, just give it a go and see what happens. And yeah, that's what happens with parents, right?
Exactly.
They know what they're doing. And then, so what happened then? So you took it for a week.
So that's interesting, because like the first day that I went to the university and the class, I heard someone is teaching mathematics, and I went to that class and I was like, that's the wrong place, I should be here. But I said, and the teacher wrote like 5 questions and he said, solve these questions, I want to see what's the level of the class. And I barely could answer 2 of them. And I was so upset. I went home and I was like, I'm done. This is all mathematics.
Yeah.
But then the next day we had programming class. And the good point about that is it was in English and it was more about like creativity. So I really liked it and I performed very well in the class. So that's how it made me a little bit more interested to computer science.
So it was reframed as like problem solving rather than just you're going to learn this theoretical thing today, right?
Yes.
So it was a different. And we'll come back to that again later, because that's how you guys have approached the learning for the girls in your schools too. And then, you know, talk to me about some of the challenges that we might not necessarily think about as, you know, I grew up in London. A lot of people listen to this are in the US or Europe. We probably take education for granted. Most of us get to go to school for free. Could you remember any times where you really struggled for basic necessities?
Yes. So I remember when we moved to Herat, first of all, we had only 3 hours electricity per day. So, and the electricity was only coming like when it was getting dark, for example, from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. So you had only electricity. There were not a lot of TV. We didn't have any program.
Yeah.
Forget about computer and internet or phone. We have, even in infrastructure wise, we only had well at home to drink the water, and all the roads are unpaved, so the infrastructure was really bad. And that time I was going to computer science faculty, so that was like the struggles. I remember that I actually studied calculus, the book for mathematics, under the light of a candle.
Oh yeah.
Yes, for a lot of nights. And I remember I actually did my last term exam also like with a candle, and I was like, I can't believe this is happening to me.
So in Iran, did you have more electricity?
Yes, I mean, in Iran, it's 24/7 hours electricity, healthy water. The infrastructure is definitely way better than Afghanistan.
And what about now in Afghanistan? Is that still the case? Are people still only getting 3 hours of electricity?
No, actually, that's interesting, because like the impression that I went to Afghanistan with all these challenges I said, now that I look back, we actually have paved roads. And actually, the road that I took from Herat border to Herat city was very unpaved bad. Like maybe it takes 6 to 7 hours to get to the city. Now it takes only 3 hours. We have almost 24/7 hours electricity. We do have internet. We do have actually 85% of people in Afghanistan out of 30 million access phone. So that's huge impact. And so we did a lot of progress.
Let's fast forward to you're getting good at programming and you start to like it. And so much so that you ended up teaching it. So tell me about that. How did that happen?
Yeah, so I became one of the first mentors in our faculty to teach Java programming. And it's interesting because like I was a student that I came from Iran, as a person who lived in Iran. So my accent was Iranian. They could understand me, but my accent was different. And not a lot of my classmates were happy about that. They didn't like that I speak like an Iranian accent, so they were make fun of me. But also beside that, because I was always a vocal person, active in social activities, and I didn't mind at all what people talk about me behind my back. So I remember that when I became the first mentor teaching Java programming, out of 200 students in the faculty, in the first class, only less than 10 people showed up. And the reason was that they were like, oh, like we don't want to go and learn from a girl.
Yeah.
Because like it's a very male-dominated culture. So not a lot of people showed up in my class.
Was it just the girls that turned up?
Yes. The only,
were there any guys?
Yes. Only audience were girls. No guys at all.
All right. And I think I remember you mentioning there was some kind of mean stuff that happened. Like, do you remember anything around that?
Yeah, because again, they weren't used to see like the girls being vocal, talking about like the things that they want and participating in projects. So they weren't happy with that. So I remember the times that some people found my email and they sent me like some not nice emails, and they wanted to discourage me about what I'm doing. And then also like one day I remember that they put some nice night wars on a paper. They wrote it and I put it on the wall. And when I came, some of my classmates said that we just took it from the wall and they wrote about you bad stuff.
Yeah.
So
how did you turn that around? Because it sounds like after some time people started attending. What did you do to navigate that?
Yeah, you know, I certainly believe in time and being patient.
Yeah.
So I was just like focusing on what I want to do. And then the thing with me as a mentor in Java is that I was teaching in Farsi. And because we had teachers that they were teaching in English, the issue with all the students was that they didn't have a good English knowledge. So they had to come to my class.
Okay. And just for people that don't know, what are the languages? Because there's several languages in Afghanistan, right? So there's Pashto, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so the main languages that they speak is Dari and okay. Pashto.
Dari, how do you?
Dari, like, D-A-R-I.
Okay.
Which is, it's interesting because you say Dari, it's the same as Farsi, Persian. But the issue is that Dari is a different accent and Farsi Iranian is a different accent. Oh,
okay, so if you're speaking Farsi, people can understand you, but it's just like a different dialect. Or...
Exactly. It's like British English and American English.
Oh, okay, all right.
Yeah.
Even in Britain, we have different dialects.
Yeah.
Even in London. All right, so people started turning up. And by this point, had you decided that you wanted to be a teacher or something? Or... I mean, were you just doing it for extra credit? What was the motivation for you doing this in the first place?
Honestly, I always hated to be a teacher. Yeah. I don't like teaching at all. But that's funny because a lot of people say that I'm very good at like transforming knowledge and explaining.
Yeah.
So they can understand from me. Although I never wanted to be a teacher. But like that was the path that I... went through for a certain period of my time.
So by this point, you said earlier you wanted to be a lawyer. Now things have changed. So again, did you have any idea what you wanted to do after you graduated?
Not really. I was kind of like, okay, I'm now going, maybe I want to take my master's. So the next step is that I want to like have a higher education. So that was like my goal and plan for the next step.
Okay, so then we'll fast forward again. I think in between you lived in Germany for a little bit and taught there too, right? But take me to the genesis of your organization now. So where did the idea come from and how did you say, okay, I want to go and do this now?
So I remember last year, actually during this time, like last, it was like December 2014, that I really felt that now it's the time for me to go after what I always wanted to do. And it was always like how I can help the girls and women in Afghanistan, especially in technology.
Well, where did that come from? Let's go into that. So I know your mom was probably a big influence on you, but is that something that was just driven into you, or where did that idea come from in the first place, do you think?
I think I'm a visionary person. Yeah. I love dreaming, but beside that, I want to dream big, like come true and happen. And I think that, and honestly, I think that I always hated to work for people.
Mm.
I always wanted to work for myself. So
you wanted to be the boss.
Maybe that's the point. But yeah, I think that I just wanted to do something that I'm passionate and I feel that I love this work. And when I get up in the morning, I just like want to go after that.
So a lot of people I speak to struggle with that, right? Like trying to work out what they're passionate about. Is there anything that stands out as thought processes or things that you thought about to help you work that out? Like what you were passionate about?
I think for me, or generally, I think it's like when you feel that you are not motivated in the work that you're doing at this moment, I think that's the time that you actually feel that maybe there's something wrong and I'm not doing something that I really want.
Yeah.
And then you just sit with yourself and like be honest with yourself and see like what I want to do. And I think that was the time for me that I was a little bit not being motivated by the work I was doing before making Code to Inspire.
Yeah.
And I was actually for 5 to 6 months, I was jobless. I didn't have any job because I quit my job because I was upset.
Oh, right. And that is that when you were searching for something?
Yes. And I was like just like going to the coffee shops, having my notebook in front of me and trying to just like brainstorm ideas.
So how long did it take you from the first time you thought, oh, it would be great to create a school for girls? Like, do you remember the initial thought you had?
Yes. I think it was... around August, and then until January that I incorporated Code to Inspire.
What happened between August and January?
So I was just like brainstorming ideas, going after the people I knew, and I wanted them to be at my board and help me just like finding resources, analyzing the situation in Afghanistan, information gathering, cost, how much would it cost to start? So it's a lot of information gathering process, I think.
Yeah. And if you don't mind me asking, so a lot of people, I mean, that's great that you took the time to really meditate or whatever you want to call it and just really think deep. Sometimes practically speaking, people can't afford to just quit their job, right? And we'll come on to how you can afford to live even now. Is that something, were you just being able to like live at home, or how were you supporting yourself even during the 5-6 months?
So I had some savings.
Okay.
And I had also support of my family.
Okay.
But I started finding jobs, just part-time jobs. And I found out about the language school, which again, it goes back to teaching. But I think teaching languages is more fun. So yeah. I start teaching Farsi.
Okay. And you're doing that now, right?
Yes.
You did it on the side. Cool. So you have this idea and you say, okay, now I want to go and build this. So you mentioned finding the board. What happens next? How did you actually take action?
So I think certainly the first thing was finding right people. Then the second thing, you want to be legal. So you have to file a lot of papers here to register as a non-for-profit. And then the second step is that, okay, you have this idea, you want to make this happen. So what do you need? You need budget. Mm. So you have to think about how you can kind of like reach out possible donors and people who would be interested to your cause and help you.
Yeah. And actually on that, so you registered in the US?
Yes, we are registered 501c3.
Why was it that you wanted to register in the US? Like, how did that even come about as a thought process?
I think first because I was based here. So I thought about, if I want to make an organization, I want to register here. And then the second is that certainly I wanted to act as an international.
Mm.
So if you're registered here in US, there are like more opportunities for you. So that's the reason that I registered in the United States.
Oh, so I think I skipped a step then. So how did you end up in here in the US in the first place?
I came in November 2012 because I co-founded another non-for-profit, which we opened Media Labs for the Girls in Afghanistan.
Cool. So if someone is sitting here listening in another part of the world, you know, wherever it might be, Brazil, India, anywhere, what's the process like for someone trying to apply to move to the US when they're trying to build a nonprofit?
Oh, I think for the first one that I came for my work, I had a sponsor. So my sponsor sponsored me, and then I came here, and with them, we started filing the papers.
Oh, okay. So you had to go and find that sponsor.
Yes.
How did you find the sponsor? Was it?
That's interesting. Yeah. They found us online
because
we were doing some other projects in Afghanistan, and then they found us online. And then I came here for 1 month's trip, only for 1 month, to the US, and I met them. And then that's how we started the conversation with them, and they started helping us.
So you mentioned fundraising. So for people that don't know what that process is like, what are the typical things that you're looking for? I know there's grants, and you guys have been awarded like a Google Rise Award, right? Which is a monetary grant, I think, as well. And you got some funding from, well, who were the other people and how did you get those?
Yes. Well, I think people who are in the non-for-profit sector, they know that like this is the most difficult work you're doing at the fundraiser and fundraising to keep the organization working. So for the first fundraising that we did, it was on Indiegogo. So we did an online crowdfunding. Our goal was to raise $20,000, but we raised $22,000. And we got also 20 laptops in-kind donation from Overstock. And with that money and with this laptop, we actually could open our first coding school in Herat in Afghanistan on November 2015.
So, and Overstock were one of the grants too, right? So is that just the laptop that they donated, or was it like a money as well? How does that normally work?
Yeah, they did an in-kind donation. Mm. So they gave us the laptops. They took care of the shipping to Dubai. So they shipped all the laptops to Dubai and then we sent it to Herat.
Okay, so tell me about that, because why were they sending it to Dubai in the first place?
Because when you talk about Afghanistan, the shipping process is like a huge nightmare.
All right.
Like, first of all, it's very costly. It's very costly if you want to ship anything from here to Afghanistan directly, and it takes a long time. So the overstock people were kind enough to kind of ship it to Dubai, which is the nearest hub to Afghanistan. Mm. And then from Dubai, we found some people who helped us to ship it to Herat, which took 30 days something to get the laptops in Afghanistan.
All right. Yeah, I guess it's not as straightforward as just sending it via FedEx. Or
no,
like
not at all.
And then what about the Google grant? How did that come about?
So we found out about Google's Rise Award, which was an award for underserved communities that are helping girls to learn computer science. So we just applied to that award, and we got that award. It's a 25K grant from Google, and with additional technical supports also.
So you just go online and apply for it?
Yeah.
There's no, okay.
There's like an application.
Okay.
You write the application, you submit it, and then they get back to you.
All right. And actually, since we're talking about Google, I saw recently, a couple of weeks ago, you were featured on the Google. I know you're very modest about it, but you were featured on the Google homepage, right? Which is super rare. I think underneath the Google search bar, it said something about coding changes lives or something like that. And you clicked it and your face was there. How did that whole thing come about? That's a pretty big deal.
Yeah. So we found people from Made with Code. It's an initiative again from Google that they are encouraging teen girls to learn computer science. And then they found out about our initiative and they were interested to feature us in their campaign. So they reached out to us and we were featured in their video. And then that day they actually launched the campaign and how it was being featured at the main page of the Google.
Yeah, okay. For people that are looking to fundraise, I mean, you've gone through this process now and you've been fairly successful in getting some really big names behind you. There must have been some others that you probably got rejected by too, I guess. So are there any learnings that you've taken from that process that you would recommend to someone else? If I was starting today and wanted to fundraise, is there anything you'd give me advice on doing?
Yes, I think first of all, definitely you have to reach out as many as people you can think about, because not a lot of them going to reply you back, and you will face a lot of no, or they can't do that. And I think it's just like you don't have to be disappointed, because there are a lot of people going to say no to you. And then reach out to your personal network, who are passionate about what you do, who likes like the missions that you like. They actually can be your advocate and your ambassador, and they can help a lot bringing more attention.
Yeah. So, I mean, even for this podcast, I've been going through a similar process of basically telling every person I've ever met about this project. So even tactically, are there certain tools that you use to help with that? I mean, are you just going on Facebook, Twitter, or your social networks and messaging people directly? Or I'm curious if there's anything that you've seen has helped you in that process.
I think one of the most important thing that I learned is that you have to keep your audience, like your previous donors or people who care about your cause, updated as much as you can. So, for example, every 2 weeks we send a newsletter. So we update our people in our network about what we accomplished, what is coming, the news, what's going on in Afghanistan, so that people feel connected to the cause, and they feel that, yes, like the money that they spend or whatever they did, it actually went to a meaningful cause and they see the impact. So definitely engaging your audience and your donors is the most important thing to keep the fund coming and raising fund.
And what about, so one part was fundraising, right? The second part, which we've kind of touched on, is building awareness of the cause and all the great work you guys are doing. So what about outreach to press and telling your story? Were there certain things, you know, you mentioned email already, but those are people that you already know. What about the press? And you've been featured in the New York Times, PBS, I think, recently, and a bunch of different publications. Has that all just come to you, or did you proactively go to anyone?
So that's interesting that the very first month that I started, and I really wanted to get the word out and let the people know. I used social media a lot, and especially on Twitter, I went and I searched about tech writers or people who like techs, and I just reached out to every of them. And I said that, hi, this is me. I'm doing this. I just want to
just
raise
on Twitter, or did you try to find their email address? Or
I mean, those who I could find their email address, I emailed them. But if not, I followed them. I sent a message. I actually went on LinkedIn. I found people. So that's how I started like making people paying attention to my work. And other people that I knew in my network, I asked them if they know any person in any publications that they would be interested to write about us. And that's how I started engaging people.
Yeah. Again, on that process, was there anything you'd do differently? I mean, it sounds like it's worked really well for you guys so far, but is there anything you said after, oh, I should have not done that, or I could have been more effective if I did it like this? Because after a lot of trial and error, like I can think of some examples, like I should have been emailing people way before I have been. Like I've just been like pushing on social, telling people. But when I've sent emails out to people, people actually read emails, even though it sounds like no one reads emails anymore. Like everyone at least kind of opens it if they know me. And I've missed the boat on that. I should have done that a lot more. So I'm just curious if there's any learnings or things you would have done differently.
I think for me, I really try to use the social media as much as I could, especially Twitter and LinkedIn. Mm. I found a lot of people in LinkedIn and Twitter. I just tweeted them, like at the name, and then, hey, I'm doing this. I'm interested that talk to you. And then they may came back to you or not, but then you can like, don't spam them, but like once a while again, tweet to them and update them. So I think in my case, social media played a really important role.
So that's really interesting. So now we've got to a stage where you've got some fundraising and you actually need to go and implement those plans, right? So what did that whole process look like? You actually had to physically get a school made, or you know, find a space to host the girls, find girls to actually teach. How did you navigate that?
So that was one of the also challenging part of the project, because I was based in New York City. So I had to do all the works online without being present physically in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So I tried to first reach out to my former students in computer science and share the work. And I got a lot of good feedback from a couple of them. So with them, we start making the team. So we had our project manager and we had our mentors.
So the people that you first kind of hired in that region were ex-students?
Yes, they were all my students.
Oh, no way. Are they still, is it like 90%?
They actually graduated 1 year ago or 2 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
And by this point, you had raised enough money that were you able to pay people, or is it like a voluntary thing? How does that work in that world?
We were able to pay a little bit to our mentors and our project managers. So it was kind of like a paid work for them.
And that kind of brings up a topic we had discussed at lunch that day. A lot of even startup founders that I meet, a lot of them would say, I didn't have much money in the beginning. You know, in this case, it's probably even more so the case, right? Like even if you have some funding, it's going to the schools and the girls and paying those people. So how have you been able to hustle your way into living in New York, which, you know, New York's not a cheap place to live?
So, yeah, I mean, I try to do some freelance work and translation and teaching Farsi, having students, and also like, again, support of my family. So I could kind of like survive in New York City. So, yeah, it's certainly very difficult if you want to start without not getting paid at all.
Yeah. Okay. And when do you know? I interviewed Scott Harrison, the guy who started Charity Water on this, and Aaron Zekis from Sundara. And I think both of them now get a salary. So, and a lot of nonprofit, obviously, you would have to get some sort of salary at some point. When do you think is the right point to know that you can take a salary at a nonprofit?
I think whenever it all again depends on how much fund you're raising. So when you are in the level that you feel confident that you secure your fund for whatever certain amount of time is that, then you can think about that's the time that I may can get paid, like whatever reasonable amount is that for you.
Great. So you've now got this school and you've got the first class of girls. Take me through that whole journey. Did you go back to Afghanistan to work on this as well, or it's all been completely remote?
All being completely remote.
You haven't even been there physically to see it?
No, unfortunately.
No way. Okay.
Yeah. So, I think, again, like working online has a lot of good points, but also like when you can't be physically there, it's also like challenging. So what we did the first, we got the endorsement from the education department of Herat. So our mentors could go to the public schools and talk about our coding school and recruit the students. So we had 150 applicants at the first place, where we took an English and computer exam and we accepted 50 students. They were from different educational backgrounds, from high schools to computer science. And we actually found one of the most important thing for us is to find a place which is safe and secure, and also the family feel comfortable sending their daughters. So we found out a very good spot of a co-working space near to the university campus and a couple of schools for girls, so the commute would be easy for the girls to come.
Great. And I know there are people in the US working on getting more girls into coding. But there are some very unique challenges that you guys face in Afghanistan. So there have been stories in the news about acid being thrown into people's faces. Obviously, there's the case of Malala where she was shot, because she wanted to get an education. So how are you ensuring or trying to protect the security of the girls and the safety of them?
So the reason that it's only for girls is that, like, majority of the families, they feel comfortable when they send their daughter to a place which is only women and girls. So our coding school is only for the girls. It's in a very convenient place of the city. So it's easy for them to travel to home and also to go to school. But also, I think what we really did is that we try to establish a very good relationship with the community, talking about Afghanistan and having these cultural and traditional issues. The family are the key to your success. Mm. So if you want to really be successful, you have to have their trust. So we had actually fathers and the brothers who came to our coding school and checked our place.
Oh, really?
And they were so happy. And they actually became our advocate to invite other girls and their relatives to come. So I think that's how we wanted to keep the tradition, but also make the girls to learn coding.
Yeah. And is there still this stigma attached to girls becoming educated in society there? Or I know it's obviously changed since the Taliban regime, but are you still facing those issues there where people are not encouraging girls to go to school and learn stuff like this?
Yeah, absolutely. I am certainly in, for example, in villages, remote areas, still a lot of girls, first, they don't go to school because there's no school for them, or they barely can finish their primary school. There's no like high school for them, or don't even think about university degree that they can go, except some big cities that, yes, people are a little bit more open-minded about sending their daughters to schools. But still, there are a lot of extremists and people who don't like women get education because they don't want women get education, so they know about their rights and they stand for themselves.
And you've had some bad press on social media, is the word you use, I think. Or you had some, again, mean people tweeting at you, whatever it might have been, when you launched, right? So do you remember any of those stories? Because one thing I like to do on this podcast is, you know, it's great to celebrate all the great things that people have done. But in everyday life, there's a ton of stuff that goes wrong and a lot of people don't often talk about it. So it would be good to just to hear those bad times too, and how you manage to navigate and deal with those things.
Yeah, I mean, certainly when you are talking about educating women, which is a sensitive topic in Afghanistan, and then helping them to be empowered and be financially independent, not a lot of people are going to be happy about that thing. Talking about technology, again, it's a very male-dominated not only even in Afghanistan, you can see here also that there are a lot of men rather than women. But I remember that whenever we were posting on our social media, for example, Facebook, about like today our students learn how to, for example, make a simple game with Unity. So there were like some...
With what, sorry?
With Unity.
What's that for people?
So
that
Unity
don't know
is one of this recent technology that virtual reality actually works on that.
Yeah.
So it's more like a gaming platform to create games, but also you can create mobile applications. It's something very new in Afghanistan, and I mean the VR and virtual reality also it's something new technology.
Yeah.
But then we had some people who commenting, and the funny thing is that some of them actually were my former students, and they were like, oh, like the girls are learning Unity because the boys already learned it and they made a lot of stuff. Now it's the time for girls. So they were trying
like
to
they're
mock
trying to
it.
Say to catch up or
yes,
something.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh, actually, you know, the place for the girls is just like be at home, bring babies and like clean the house. Anyways, they're going to marry and they're not going to use these skills. So they try to like discourage and like mock. What
were they
we
tweeting
do.
At you or just sharing that themselves?
They actually post in their Facebook, shared our post and then commented.
Oh,
on
really?
The,
okay.
Yes, commented on the social media, and then you could see a bunch of conversation
comments
going
and
on.
And these are people
that.
You know.
There were some people who, some of them I know.
Are you
them.
Still friends on Facebook?
I'm not actually. It's funny because like it's not because they posted that stuff. I'm not friend with them. I was just not friend with them for a long time.
Okay.
But then my mentors one day get so upset and they took a screenshot and sent me and told me, look what they are talking about. And
okay, so that I mean that's a very unique, terrible thing to have to deal with. But in anyone who's building something, there's always negative feedback in some way. How did you deal with that? And more mentally, more than anything?
Yeah, I think just like, I love them. I love the critics.
Haters gonna hate.
Yes, I think you have to just like embrace them. For me, I think what it works is that like they actually are the key for my success because like they make me more motivated to go after my dream. So what I do, I took a screenshot. I have the screenshot of the comments in my laptop, but I also printed and
really?
In front of me. So once a while I look at them and I'm seeing these people are discouraging me and want me to stop to prove that, yes, they're right and I'm not doing the right thing, which I actually a very... I actually always, when these things happen, it makes me more motivated to show them that not they're not right.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that it's just like, I just look at them and smile.
Yeah. You do a lot better than a lot of people I know, including myself. Sound like you've got a good attitude about it. Great. So that's the tip for anyone listening. Take a screenshot, put it on your desk and let it motivate you, because there's always going to be people that have negative things to say. So that kind of leads us on to, the future and what you guys are trying to build for the long run. You've already had some incredible success in such a short amount of time. But tell me what you guys are trying to build in the next 5-10 years. Where would you like to take this organization?
So I think my ultimate goal with Code to Inspire is that definitely our biggest mission is to find job employment for our girls so they can do work online without being worried of safety, security, family concerns, and they can earn income. But beside that, I certainly want to create a strong network of women in tech in Afghanistan, which we are lacking at this moment, by building more coding schools in other cities like Kabul, Mazar-e-Sharif. So connect all these women together that they can support and also create more job opportunities for women in Afghanistan.
You mentioned job opportunities, and one of the things you guys do specifically is your style of teaching is very practical, not just academic. And you have an academic background. So talk to me about that and why you've gone with the practical route.
I think when you talk about academic and the environment there, it's just like a curriculum that they want you to have a deep knowledge of like a specific thing. For example, operating system or like certain languages, you learn about them. But there's always a lack of practical work. And once you graduate from computer science, you're not ready to connect to the job market because you've never been trained to be like connected to the job market. The skills they need in the job market is way different than you as a person graduate.
Yeah.
So that's what we try to not to do in Code to Inspire. We try to have a job-driven curriculum, a project-based curriculum that once the students finish it, they actually build something.
Because in the second year, it's a two-year program, right?
Yes, we offer... It's kind of like we extend the program as long as we see that our students still need to be with us.
Okay.
So like the first year is educational, second year is more advanced skills. So we'll see, like we can extend our curriculum.
And so the second year, it sounds like people, they if they have an idea, they can try to build it. Right?
So exactly. Yes.
Has that happened yet or that's going to be happening soon?
Yes. So for this year, actually, because on this November, we are going to celebrate a 1 year old anniversary of Code to Inspire. So actually, our students are making some projects. There are a couple of projects that they're building. And one of them is that our students are trying to make an app for the tourists who are interested to come to Afghanistan. So it's an informative app, but also like something fun to give more information about Afghanistan.
Are there any girls that you, I know you haven't had a chance to meet them yet physically, but you've probably heard some stories about what they're building and the types of characters you have there. Are there any fun stories that you've heard from the people working there and you know how it's impacted their lives?
Yeah, so I have a couple of them actually friends that are with me on Facebook and on Twitter. The most interesting thing that I always get from them is that when every morning I wake up, I check our Code to Inspire Twitter account and I see that like we have 15 to 20 students tweeting to us about what they've done during that day, but a screenshot of the work. So that's like amazing to see that these girls are being so engaged and vocal about what they do. We had actually a couple of students coming from a very, it's not a financially good family background,
yeah,
but they were so committed to come and we helped them by giving them like extra materials and encouraging them. And they are actually one of our best students that they come up with a great idea of developing the app and making some games. So we already see that like how within this time period, they became more outstanding and they really have like a vision for their future.
Yeah. So that brings up the topic of women in technical fields overall. So your background is in academia and you were in classrooms with a lot of men and you were teaching a lot of men. And even in the US and around the world, those technical roles, programming, engineering, are often dominated by men. So I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts on why you think that is in the first place. And then the second part to that is how we can change that as a society.
Yeah, so I think that like whenever you say coding and computer programming, the first thing that comes to anybody's mind is like a guy sitting on a like a basement of a house and a lot of soda drinking and making a lot of like coding.
Yeah.
With a big glasses, I think.
Yeah.
But that's like the stereotype that like the people think about it. And unfortunately, I think what I see always like in advertising and like in movies, you always see men doing all these technical works like the hackers or like the mastermind behind something like related to computer science are all men. So this actually eventually will kind of like influence on people's mind that like it's just something for men or men are more capable than women of doing that, which is not true.
Yeah. It's actually the complete opposite. Like from my research, it looked like if you look at men and women specifically, women most of the time would outperform on average men, not just academically, but specifically for coding.
That's interesting because I saw actually a data that shows that like during the 1950s and 60s, the number of women in computing and engineering were increasing so much.
In the 90s, you said?
In 50s and 60s.
Oh, 50s and 60s.
And then all of a sudden after that, it dropped so drastically, very bad. And I think it's all about how they represent the like a character of being in the computer science, in ads or in everything as a man. So I think that's like all more like a cultural thing it become. It's become like more like a bro culture. So like it's programming, I think. So the same as Afghanistan, but then again in Afghanistan, again, the situation is even more difficult because there are a lot of cultural restrictions. I remember that when I was teaching in a class, which majority of them were guys, my female students, they didn't have this courage to raise their hands and ask questions. They weren't engaged in a lot of activities. And once they came to me after class, I was like, why you don't raise your hands in the class and just be engaged with the guys? And they were like, we don't want to be make fun of, or we just felt not comfortable. So I think these are like all the reasons that make women kind of like being pushed back and not being active really in the computing and engineering field.
Yeah. What about systemic issues, like with the education system? Do you think that's also an issue? Like even from a young age, before college, like, you know, when we are 7, 8 years old, do you think that has an impact in what happens later down the road?
Yes, I think it's also the same because like if you see in a very young age, you see the kids, again, like the boys plays more games than the girls. Yeah. So like from that age, they build like this kind of like differentiating the girls from the boys, that the boys can like play a lot of games. And that actually helped them to be more creative because like they learn a lot of games and they became more interested in computer science. Yeah. And then the girls are just like more maybe towards like art or like something which is not really related to technical.
So as a society or parents, what are some of the things you think we can do to change that? You know, I think we've identified some of the issues, but, you know, obviously what you guys are doing is definitely helping us move in the right direction. But apart from creating these sort of programs, which I think are incredibly important, what other things do you think we can do as individuals?
I think from the very early stage, like from the very early age of education for children, that would be great if we can kind of like engage them with very simple educational, like for example, apps or like programs that they can play around. Or like, even though I think mainly programming is also like solving puzzles and it's like critical thinking. So it's just like if you like solving puzzles and playing games, you can enjoy programming. So like if you can like give some small like puzzles, building something, like even like a simple thing physically, not, I mean, it doesn't necessarily should be something being on a computer. It just like build the creativity in the kid, try make them to be more creative. I think that's actually helped them a lot to be interested in technical fields and engineering fields.
Yeah. That's a really interesting point. Do you think that is also to do with role models? You know, if you think to growing up who your role models were.
I think that may be also like an issue that they are searching for like a woman who is influential in the field that they like. So they can look at her and just like follow the path. So certainly it's also about diversity and not finding like a role model in a diverse way.
Yeah, because I do think like technology has become super cool in the last 5-10 years anyway. Everyone has a smartphone, people use social networks, and they're just exposed to people like Mark Zuckerberg. Or, you know, I've met a bunch of high school kids and they're like, we want to be like Mark Zuckerberg, you know, and that's great. But again, I do think that makes technology and programming cool in one way, but at the same time, we still maybe need more role models that are showcased, that look like different people, you know. And that's not just a male, a female thing. That's also ethnicity and different backgrounds altogether.
Yeah, I think also like in the history of computer science and programming, if you look, there are a lot of women that being ignored. And you see women completely erased from the history of computing. Like today actually is the day of Ada Lovelace, and she's like one of the very first people and like the first woman who created like computer coding and language programming. So I think you don't see these names being highlighted in the history of computers. So like the girls will know that actually there were a lot of women at the very first who did a lot of influential work in case of computing.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe as a follow-up to this, I'll have to go and find some of those names and share them at least in the blog post so people can research them and check them out. I don't know as much as I should know about that too, so thanks for mentioning that. Well, that's been super interesting. Thanks so much for sharing your story and the inspirational stuff you guys are working on. The last section to close things off, I just like to have kind of a fun getting to know you section and just discuss some random topics just to get to know you a bit better. So I'll kick things off with, you know, success is something that we use quite broadly and it means different things to different people. What does success mean to you personally?
I think I can interpret success in a way that whenever I get up in the morning and I'm doing what I love and I make an impact, even in a small way, that's a success for me.
What about for the organization itself? How do you guys measure success?
Certainly for us, measuring the success is to educate as many as girls we can in coding, but then definitely get them job and be financially independent.
Yeah.
So that would be like our huge success.
That's the longer term vision, right?
Yes.
So, cool. So what about other people that you look to outside of, it doesn't have to be in coding or computer science or anything like that. When I say the word successful, who are other people that you think of?
I think I always being inspired by Rumi. I always...
For people who don't know who that is.
Rumi is one of the very influential poets.
Yeah.
Persian in Farsi. So I always look up at him and I read his poems and writings that found it very inspirational, especially in the very depressed moment and sad moment of my life.
Yeah.
I found them very motivating and inspirational for myself.
That's really cool. I've got a book next to my bed as well, Rumi. So I don't read it as much as I should, but it's next to my bed just in case. You know? actually, it looks like you're reading my questions, but the next one I had was about feeling lost. Do you remember the last time you felt completely lost and down or depressed, whatever you want to call it? When was that and how did you deal with it? Whatever you're happy to share, of course.
Yes, I think that was the time that I left my former foundation and I was in a moment that I really didn't know what to do. At some point I just wanted to go back to Afghanistan. I felt so alone and I didn't know what I want to do in my life, and that was a lot of struggles.
And to remind people, so the way you got out of that was just to take your time now and be patient, and you asked yourself a bunch of questions, right?
Yeah.
What are there any books that changed the way you think about something or really stand out to you that really impacted you?
I mean, because like looking at my background, literature, I read a lot of writings, especially the Persian writers. And I like Sohrab Sepehri. He's one of the very...
You're going to have to spell that for me.
Yeah. Sohrab Sepehri. And I found his thoughts and his writing very peaceful and like very, very inspirational to me. So I think I really feel connected to him.
Great. What does he write about? Is it fiction or like he's writing stories and stuff, or is it more he's talking about something else?
So he's a very famous poet.
Okay.
We call them in a new generation of poets in Farsi. And he's... poems are very spiritual, and he talks about all the religions, and he went to a lot of countries. So he looked at the world in a different perspective, and he actually like lived with everything. So, like, for example, he can talk about like something that is very meaningless to us, but in his way, it's just very like meaningful and quite interesting. So I certainly love and enjoy reading his writings.
So thank you for sharing all of that with us. And If people want to check out the organization and contribute, is there an ask you have for people? This is your call to action. So,
thank you. Yes. Well, thank you very much for having me and letting me to share this story with your audience. Just please check our website, code2inspire.org, and feel free to look at the work that we have done so far and be just our ambassador and storyteller. Share our idea and story with your friends and networks and raise more awareness, because at the end of the story, the reason that I wanted to have code2inspire beside making the girls get the job, it's also sharing a positive story about Afghanistan and change the people's mindset about Afghanistan they have in their mind, which I'm sure it's bombing, blasting, violence, but just a good story.
That's actually a bonus question, since you brought it up, is what, so you're right, like most people listening to this, I'd say pretty much everyone that isn't from Afghanistan probably hasn't visited there. So what is the image that you still have of Afghanistan? You haven't been back since you moved here, it sounds like, but what are those beautiful and positive things that you want people to think about?
So my city is very mountainous. You will see a lot of mountain, and it's a lot of beautiful views, and we have a lot of nice sightseeings. We have a lot of beautiful places of the famous poets in Afghanistan and in Herat especially, so you can go and visit that. We have a big blue mosque in Herat. So certainly there are a lot of good places in Afghanistan, in any part of Afghanistan I can name it, but unfortunately it hasn't been represented in the media the same they are.
What's your happy place in at home there? Do you have a place you go to when you really miss and you say, oh, I'm home right now?
I think one place is Takht Safar, we call it. So it's like a park up on the hill. And when you go on the hill, you actually can see the whole city under your, like you can just see the whole city. And it's so beautiful at night, because when you go and stand and see the city under the mountain, it's all just like a lot of shiny lights and it's just a beautiful view.
That's great. All right. I think that's a great way to leave it off. And everyone go do some research on TripAdvisor and sort out your next trip. Thanks so much for coming on. This is, you know, honestly, you guys are doing incredible work. And I urge everyone to go and please check them out. And please be generous. Donate to the cause as well, if you're able to. And I'm really looking forward to following your journey over the coming years. I know you're just at the beginning. So thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Thanks.
I hope you enjoyed that. If you did, please share this with your friends. I'll be bringing you some incredible guests over the coming weeks. You can subscribe on iTunes, on Stitcher, or any podcast app you're using. You can also subscribe to the email list on the website. Just go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. You'll be able to get every single episode, free giveaways, and exclusive content straight to your inbox. You can also listen to all the episodes on creatorlab.fm with all the show notes, books, links, any resources that were mentioned in the conversations. And please say hello. You can send me an email directly. That is hello@creatorlab.fm. Or just find me on any social network. The username is creatorlabfm. I look forward to hearing from you. Enjoy.